Okay, they're both recording.
All right, hit it. Welcome to As You Wish, broadcasted live deep within the earth from a little wilderness town called Trout Lake, Washington, where the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and the children, well, most of them have been abducted. UFO and Paranormal Central, a cryptozoologist's dream. Thanks for joining us. Greetings, this is James Gillen, and I'm your host. We just thought we'd have a little fun with that other intro. Trout Lake is pretty much like Lake Wobegon here, you know, because we do have quite a contingency of ministers and, you know, good old farmers and whatever else going on here. It's quite a mix, you know, of things happening here. So, and we still have a lot of those crazy things happening as well, just like Lake Wobegon. But it's kind of interesting watching all of this unfold. I wanted to cover a little bit about, we had some UFO investigators up here that were kind of hilarious. They're a bunch of older guys trying to be famous, and I guess a couple of young guys. I wasn't here when they were here, and I'm not even going to give their YouTube channel because it was so ridiculous what they did. It's not even worth mentioning because in all their efforts, they've only gotten 24 views. So obviously, not too many people are concerned with it, and I don't want to feed it any energy. But, you know, it's like, you know, it's no disrespect to apes, but, you know, it's like taking a bunch of apes and put them in a museum, you know, and then having them come back and talk about what they saw. And pretty much all they saw was the fruit bowl. You know, they didn't see anything else because they didn't have the consciousness to see anything else. And so, you know, and they came with an agenda, and that agenda was to either debunk or show some other ridiculous things. But anyway, I don't even want to give out their website because it is so beyond ridiculous watching what these people do. One of these things is that they're trying to say that everything we're seeing here are satellites, and we're just seeing, you know, satellites rolling over and the mirrors reflecting light back when they're powering up and things of that nature. But this is so beyond ridiculous because, you know, late at night, everything overhead is in the Earth's shadow. And so where's the light coming from? And these things are flying below treetop level in many cases, which have been filmed and documented on Paranormal State and the Danny Dyer special and things of that nature. People have come here and they film these. And so there's so much evidence of these objects, and some are actually physical craft filmed in the daytime. And so for them to try to make it look like all of these are satellites and meteors or things of that nature, it's just beyond ridiculous. There's no real scientific method going on here and really no logic whatsoever. Because if you do understand what's going on, you know, you'll pull out, you know, either Heavens Above or J-Tracker, and you'll see which satellites are going. You'll look at the visible satellite sections, you know, the ones you can see, and there's not very many. And when you see 50 objects flying over, and they're in the Earth's shadow, and they're lighting up and responding to lasers and people on the ground, and this has been ongoing for 25 years with here. And then also we've had Kenneth Arnold, who sighted the ships as he descended on the western slopes of Mount Adams, Dr. Jalen Hynek, Greg Long, all the other researchers that have been up here, to disqualify all that and just to think they're above all that and they're were just because they have some gear and some technology is beyond ridiculous. But anyway, when you have Air Force base commanders and triple PhD Boeing engineers and air traffic controllers and pilots and people from all walks of life coming here and seeing these objects, and even Skunk Works people and NASA as well, and they say very clearly these are not ours, these are not satellites, it kind of lays to rest their investigation right there. That, you know, discounting all of that, I would say that, you know, good luck in responding, you know, to the monkeys, because that's the monkeys are the only ones that are going to believe your program that you're putting out there. The I thought too, where they try to say orbs are dust, you know, to deal with that, it's just nothing but dust here. Well, the problem with it, when you have prevailing winds coming from the west, bending the treetops in the footage, and you have orbs flying against the wind, going into the ground, coming out of the ground, pulsing with their own power, their own energy, and you see faces in these orbs, very definable faces show up when you blow these orbs up, and they come in brilliant colors, and they're shown interacting and creating their own little vortexes and things like that. This is the smartest dust I've ever seen, and I think dust definitely doesn't act under some form of intelligence. It doesn't fly against the wind. You know, it doesn't swirl into little mini vortexes over people's heads and interact with kids and children and actually interact with you when we put on the night vision with the infrared spotlight. You can actually see these orbs real time flying around on video, interacting with people. So yes, there is dust in the world, but that doesn't mean there aren't orbs either. You know, so if you want to focus on the dust, you know, have fun with that one. That's pretty much where you're at. You know, you're in the dirt. You know, so if you want to step out of the dirt, that's great. You know, and get a bigger picture. But anyway, that being said, you know, we've got some wonderful people here that have been to the ranch that have taken the time, and we have some brilliant minds here, and some are scientists and things like that that would love to share their story. And you know, and these are going to be getting millions of views versus the 24 views that these guys got, you know, trying to make a name, you know, at other people's expense. But we're going to see if we can get the landline here at ESETI, get the we have the field line and the landline, you know, for the Skywatch field, and hopefully we can get them on the air. Is there anybody with us yet? Do we have a hookup?
Yeah, John's on the line here. That's me.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
John.
Hi, James. How are you?
Doing great.
Good. So, well, I'm not a scientist, but I've been here for a couple of days. And the first night, it wasn't really that busy. The full moon kind of, I guess that probably affects things out here. The light was, the moon being real bright, you couldn't see the sky that well. But last night, it was a little bit different. And there was two or three, four ships that came in pretty low and powered up really good. It was the first time that I've really seen anything quite like that here, being my second trip here. So it was pretty spectacular. I could feel it. I think everybody that was here in the crowd last night was pretty excited about the whole thing. The energy was great. It was just great. And I think the people were every bit as exciting as what was going on up in the sky. For me, it's been interacting with the people and watching what's going on. The whole thing is just, it's been great. I love coming here. Like I said, the ground show is great, too. It's a good time, and the sky lit up pretty good last night. So I was just having a great time.
Great.
It was really good.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about your experiences energetically here since you've been here? I know you went through the transpersonal release session and also out in the field.
Okay. So I kind of came down here for – well, I was here for the summer conference. That was my first trip up here. And I was really thrilled to death with the whole thing. The speakers were fantastic. The energy was – can I say off the planet? Mm-hmm. It was great. So I went home and I wanted to come right back down. And because I'm only 4 hours away, I'm able to do that. So I set up a, I guess we're calling that a transpersonal healing. Is that right, James?
Yeah.
Okay. So last night before the Skywatch, I did that with James and Jana, and it was quite an experience for me. Connected with some stuff that I had no clue was really going on with myself. But the bell rang really true. It all fit real good. And I think it really opened up some doors for me. I could feel the energy of Kazekiel real strong in the room that I'm sitting in right now when we were doing this. And when I left after the experience, it was like something had changed. I can't really describe that, but something had changed. So it was what I came for.
Great.
And I would recommend that to anybody. If you're looking for finding out stuff about yourself and getting a little bit more in touch with your guides and going on that journey, it's a fantastic tool. And James did a fantastic job, and as he does with this whole East Eddy Ranch, it's just it's great. It's great. So, What can I say?
Yeah. Hey, well, it's just awesome. I love seeing people, pop open and just feel the love and the joy and the bliss and be introduced to their real self, their true self, minus the baggage, I call it,
I think you just said it right there. Getting in touch with another me is kind of what it felt like. The long lost me, or the me that I've been looking to reacquaint with. Mm-hmm. And it was all of that. I was not disappointed at all. I didn't really know exactly what to expect from the whole experience, but I wasn't disappointed at all. It was really good.
It's really good to come in with no expectations and just allow.
I was trying to be a little bit of an open slate and just kind of see what happened. Yeah. And I think more than I've actually downloaded has happened. And it's, my experience first time here is when I left, there was still stuff going on. And I think when I leave here again, I'll probably still be downloading some of the stuff that happened on my my journey down here this time. So, it's just really good. I just feel really good about the whole thing, the whole journey here. The Skywatch is great, and the people here, the energy of the people, I think, for me, is every bit as much as the energy that I'm feeling from the skies, just interacting with everybody and their experiences and journey and the magic that happens when you get people of like minds together is really going on here. So the ground crew, I guess, maybe. Mm-hmm. Is what it is, and it's a powerful thing. It's been a powerful thing for me.
Thanks a lot for coming on the show and sharing your experience. Keep up the great work, and we'll probably see you out in the field a little later.
Okay, anyway, I've got Angie here that would like to say a few words.
Great.
Okay, I'll put her on now.
Hi, James.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor.
The honor's all mine. I think you reinstated my faith in living angels on the earth.
Aw. Thank you. Well, I've had such a great time here, and like John was saying, it's been nothing, there's no disappointments. It's been bigger and better than I ever could have imagined, and I think the people are such a big part of that. All the people here are just so welcoming and so loving, and I think it's no coincidence that, we're all drawn here together at the same time, and, for the guests and the people living here as well just have been so open and, just more than I could have imagined. Mm-hmm. And have made my experience so so incredible. And, it's been my dream to come here since I found out about East Eddy which was about a year and a half ago. And I came here from New York. And, the whole thing has been great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about the, some of your experiences out in the Skywatch field, some of the things you've seen out there, and then after that, maybe we can talk about, some of the energy things that you've experienced.
Yeah. Well, last night we arrived around 6, and we set up our tent and everything, and we came out to Skywatch with everyone before the moon had come up, but it was already dark. And at that time, I couldn't believe how quickly things sort of started happening. And I wouldn't say I had any doubts, but you just don't imagine that it could be that easy, to see these ships up in the sky, and they're so unmistakably what they are. There's just no possibility of them being anything else. And watching them power up was just such a thrill. You just feel just this giddiness and this laughter come over you that it's just uncontrollable, and you just let it go, and you just loving it, everybody's just loving it. I think there's just this feeling of love all around, and I think we must have seen about at least 20 ships, right?
Probably
around at least, just, yeah. All different directions, coming in from all these different directions, and, we'd all spot different ones, and then you'd come out with the, your night vision goggles, and I think that makes it a little easier to spot them. And they were totally reacting to the lasers, and that was really fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for a first experience, it was, it was really mind-blowing. And it just became, it's amazing how, you're out there and you're watching these things flying around the sky, and you just almost become so okay with it so quickly. It just makes, mm-hmm. Yeah, of course they're out there. And then we saw some flashes on Mount Adams, which were pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Like a still light, which, there's no way of any human being up there. What else? Oh, I also saw these like flashes through the trees, like really fast, way too bright and too big to be a shooting star or anything, and too close. Mm-hmm. Just flashing through the trees. It was great.
The mountain lights. When this other group was here, these UFO investigators, they saw like 6 lights all over the mountain. They seemed to be moving on the mountain. And they came to the conclusion that they were headlamps on hikers. and the mountain is at least 13 to 17 miles away, depending on what part of the mountain you're looking at. But, you can't see a headlight 13 miles away. And not that big. I mean, these are massive, massive lights. The candle power of these lights is off the scale. And they're in areas and moving around areas. They're moving down glaciers over huge lava rocks off of lava cliffs and moving around on the ground. And these guys just ascertain them to be headlights of campers or hikers up there. And there's a wilderness area up there. You can't take a vehicle anywhere near that area because it's just because of the designation. So it's definitely not a snowmobile, which you'd probably barely see anyway up there, a snowmobile, and it's definitely not a little headlamp that a hiker would be carrying,
that would be crazy. You'd have to have some kind of like some kind of stadium light or something up there all of a sudden assembled, And I think you kind of have to be there, you kind of have to see it to really understand, you kind of have to be as close as we are to mm-hmm. really get it.
These guys were actually here and saw them, and that was their conclusion that these were campers with little headlamps on. And
people that were here thought that? Oh, that's crazy.
I go, my God,
I think some people just, if they don't, if they'll find an excuse for anything, however bizarre their own excuse sounds,
Exactly.
They're the ones that start sounding crazy, I think.
Yeah, in the end, when you break it down and you look at the lack of logic and the lack of base science that using, I mean, we have NASA people coming here and viewing the footage and seeing the level that these lights are going and the magnitude of light and the maneuvers that they're doing and everything else. And they clearly state, you know, these are not ours. These are not satellites. Mm-hmm. One guy was here. He worked on the NOS satellites, the triple satellites that everybody keeps talking about are the UFOs, you know, the triangle-shaped UFOs. Well, the problem with that system, he said that basically when they launched it, it just turned straight up sideways, and they couldn't get it to hold the shape, you know, of the triangle, and they abandoned it a long time ago. I mean, it didn't work. It was a very and so they just kept using that as a debunking tool. Oh, that's the triple NOS satellites, but we have these giant triangle ships that look like miles wide, flying, turning, making right angle turns, flipping over, going back the other way. That's pretty tricky maneuvers for a satellite. And again, you know, when you see something like that, you dismiss that as a satellite. I think they talk about people here drinking the Kool-Aid. I think they brought the Kool-Aid with them, you know, when they start making statements like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, even last night, some of those ships that we saw, there was one that was like zigzagging. A satellite can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's an old saying that the Anunnaki were the ones that brought us the grape, you know, to make the wine. And I'm starting to wonder if that's not them up there, you know, drinking the wine the way they're flying those ships.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm really excited for tonight, you know. I feel like it's just going to get better.
Oh, yeah.
So, and everybody's energy here is so great. We have more people here today, and I feel like, I'm excited for this evening.
And I think, you know, you're coming all the way from South Africa and New York to New York and then New York to here.
Yeah.
Be quite a transition, although there is a lot of activity happening over there in South Africa, especially with Michael Tellinger's work, where he's actually found the landing place of the Anunnaki, the ancient ones, and is doing a lot of incredible work there. So hopefully when you go back to South Africa, you can check into Michael, tell him you're a good friend of James's, and I'm sure he'll have some wonderful stories to tell you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be back home where I'm originally from, like you said, South Africa, back in December, and that'll be the first time in 3 years, so mm-hmm. I'll be excited to do that, and I would definitely like to check in with him and his work.
Can you, I don't know if you want to, it's up to you, but I'd love to hear just a few words about the transpersonal release session and just what you experienced there and some of the energies that you felt, you know, that came through.
Yeah, I knew I wanted to do that. I thought it would be good for me, and I really had no expectations, and I'd heard only good things from people, but it was the kind of thing where you'd ask someone what it was like, and they couldn't really describe it. And it is kind of hard to describe it because I think it's such a personal experience and it's different for everybody. But the one thing that, you know, it was like it's called, there was a lot of release, a lot of release from my past here in this life on Earth. And then there was also, you know, the connection to my spirit guide and finding out about her and just knowing about that and the love that came through from her, that love. I mean, at first, I had a hard time just accepting it, and then, you know, and I asked her to turn up her juice, and it just came through so strong. I mean, it's almost it's a lot, I think, for the physical body to kind of take on. I mean, it's a great feeling, but it's really apparent. And and I feel like, you know, I'm still processing what went on today. I mean, we did that this morning, and it was a great experience. And, you know, I went into some of my past lives, which brought a lot of clarity about things. You know, there was a lot of synchronicities or things that made sense. about that. There was a lot of things that, to me, just it made, you know, things that made sense from what I learned there.
Mm-hmm. The I know the just the energy that came in when they did the initiation was overwhelming, even for me. I just felt I got the most incredible bliss hit and love feeling, you know, from that experience. And I know a lot of people are starting to have contacts. We're having people coming up from all over the world now that are having these contacts with these, you know, Palladian beings, Andromedan beings, the Orion Council of Light beings, all of these beings. And they're kind of really having trouble with it and struggling with it. Maybe you could give them a word of encouragement on just allowing this, you know, and working with it and maybe releasing the fear and what it meant to you, you know, to work with these beings and actually connect with them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say, through the experience, having that experience here with you, James, and with Jana, I just felt so safe. You know, I felt really safe in the environment that I was and with the people that I was doing it. I had no doubt about the energies around me. And so that really helped. And I think that's important. But also, you know, yeah, I definitely felt, you know, a certain resistance to it. And I don't know why, because I wanted it so bad. And your mind plays tricks with you, you know, and you just, it's almost like a feeling of self-worthiness, I think, comes through. But I really, you know, at a certain point I knew, I was like, this is it, like, just let go. And, you know, you're encouraging with that. And I did ask if you get what you ask for. And I asked for her to turn it up. And she did. Mm-hmm. And I really, really felt it. And yeah. It's unmistakable. You know, it's...
Yeah, what's neat about that, too, is that they won't come to you. I mean, you have to invite it and you have to ask for it and initiate it or it's just not going to happen. And it's important to realize that when you did ask, you say, hey, can you turn up the juice? I really want to feel you. They did, you know, and you know, it might have been a little overwhelming when they did, but,
yeah.
But, you know, as long as you just breathe and say, I let go, I let spirit, or I let go, I let God, whatever feels good, or just move into a position of gratefulness where you just say, thank you. You know, it's amazing how all of a sudden it just, everything lets go and you just become really at peace with it.
Yeah, and like John was saying, you really do feel different afterwards. I'd heard that before, and you really do. You feel like you're your real self, you know, yourself that you've been, that you know you are, and you just like get back in touch with yourself, and you almost walk taller. I know that sounds like the ego speaking, but it's not. It's like you really just, something from your heart, just like it's loving yourself and knowing your spirit guide is there with you, and because you really know it. And yeah, you feel different afterwards. It's a great feeling.
It's very
empowering. And I know it's only going to get better.
Yeah, it's very, very empowering. It's all about individual empowerment, you know, and that's what I always tell people that, you know, as with you, is that what you're experiencing is within self, or you couldn't experience it. So you're really experiencing your own grandness, you might say. They're just helping you remember it, you know, and helping initiate you so you can experience more of yourself, you might say.
Yeah.
Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. You did a great job and explained to people, and I think putting people at peace with all these transitional energies that are coming in, and I think it's really important, you know, what you said about trust and feeling at peace and safe, because there are tools and techniques to create a real safe space and a clear environment so you can have these contacts. And I think that's imperative that people learn that and learn how to heal any unseen negative influences. It's in both books and we have it on the website. But once you learn how to clear unseen negative influences and you know the name of your main teacher and guide, you can go anywhere and have these just phenomenal experiences from there on out and feel totally safe and secure in those experiences.
Yeah. And, you know, I just want to say, it's like, we all know, like, you know, everything comes from source, and that's where everything's coming from to begin with. And having a guide is just, it's like a nice tool. It's just an extra tool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're plugged into the same energy. Yeah. They're just a little more plugged in than we are. And I love what Ezekiel said. You know, they call us the forgotten gods. And some people will say that's blasphemous. But he said the only difference between us and the greatest of all gods, you know, are different levels of forgetfulness. We just forgot that we came from the source and that we're children of God and endowed with the creative abilities of the source itself. And, you know, like Meister Eckhart said, you know, if pear seeds create pear trees and nut seeds create nut trees, what do God seeds create, you know? Mm-hmm. And famous Christian theologian. So, of course, he got pretty much chastised for that one and kicked out of the flock. But anyway, that's the bottom line. You know, if you are a child of God, you know, eventually you grow up, and then what happens?
Well, I'm going to hand you over to Giles. Because he's
right.
Dying to get on the phone with you.
All right.
Hold on a second. Thanks, James. Thanks again.
All
bye.
Hey, James. How are you going?
No, doing great. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, mate. What do you want to know?
Yeah, I just want to say it's just been awesome having you here, helping out, in the trenches and helping with the painting and all the other stuff. I mean, if it wasn't for you, I would probably be on my hands and knees right now doing this. So again, thank you. And I like the scientific element that you bring here. You know, you bring the hard science background along with a pretty enlightened approach and ability to see, you know, what's happening here on other levels.
Yeah, I mean, what have I got? 15 years of genetics background in Australia, and then I had some really whacked out experiences with things visiting me in my room, lights following my car, and I struggled for about 2 years with all those experiences, thinking that I was actually going mad. And I think this is probably something that's common with people that have these kind of experiences. And then I started looking into the subject a little bit more, and not that it took over my life, but it got to the point where sort of things in my life, society and work and certain relationships and things with people, work relationships, became kind of insignificant to me. And then I was led somehow to this place. And that, as you know, that was last weekend, and met a great group of people. And wow, man, what a relief to share your story with people that don't sit there and judge you. I mean, you try and tell this story to somebody that's been in the scientific field for 30 years or something, you know, like my supervisors, and they're just not interested. They just look at you like you're an absolute fruitcake. So, I mean, to actually come to a place where there's a lot of people that are here open-minded and they're understanding these stories and the emotions and the feelings that you go through when you've encountered these things is just, man, it's such a relief. And when I got out the car, when we arrived at this place, I walked onto your field, man, and it felt like someone had plugged me into the national grid. I don't know what is going on here, but the energy is just, it's awesome. Like, it's just, as a scientist, I haven't got a clue what's going on, but it's just out there. It really is out there.
Mm-hmm. I know I think what's fascinating is when you first came here, you started seeing like the orbs and the little green lights popping in and out and all the other things. And
yeah, I mean,
talk a little bit about that.
I mean, let alone the lights in the sky, the power-ups and stuff like that, which were cool, but I was wandering around and I could see all these little green lights popping off in the grass, and then big golden orb. Like, I mean, I take photographs of these things with my digital camera, and of course the scientific side of my brain goes, oh, look, you know, they're just dust particles or pollen or moisture in the air or whatever. And then I put the camera down, and as I'm thinking that, this huge golden orb appears in the field and zips around. And thankfully, it wasn't just witnessed by me. It was witnessed by four other people as well. And I think you were out there at the time when you heard us all scream like banshees. I mean, we were so excited. Like, it's just, I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but it's just, it's incredible, man. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah, the people that come here are just getting phenomenal photos of the orbs and these giant, just pink energies coming in. Gigantic pink lights, you know. Appearing with, looks like a radiant being, you know, inside of them, and just things of that nature. And I know with with Khan, you know, he's a Taoist monk, you know, that comes here, and he actually photographed Mary, an apparition of Mary, and an apparition of Kuan Yin, and Ezekiel's appearance, and the felines. He got just incredible photographs, and a lot of it, I think, is just because of his ability to see, you know, because he does 21-day dark retreats in caves, you know, over there in Japan. But the other one is that his frequency, his vibration, he's vibrating on that level already.
Yeah.
And we call him like the disappearing monk, because he always disappears and reappears, and he's bilocating accidentally, you know, ends up in China or Korea or something. But it's pretty funny. But somebody of that caliber coming here and just loving the energy and actually getting photographs, I think is amazing.
Yes, definitely an amazing place. And you remember that first day that I was helping you guys dig in that trench, and I saw a white orb come towards me, and I like felt a touch on my face and something glowing on my cheeks. I mean, talk about an affront to my senses, and you know, and opening. I mean, every day I spend here, my mind is just opened up that little bit more, and it's challenging for me. But you know, I definitely feel that every moment that I spend in this place, I'm starting to learn. I learn so much, especially from you and the staff here.
You know, the what's interesting, you know, going back to the scientific community, you know, not to be belligerent, but you know, the higher beings say that the intellect is a drop in the sea of consciousness, and that your emotional body, and most of them know this, that there's an IQ and then there's an EQ. And your emotional body is much more vast and processes things faster. You know, women actually process things much faster than men because they're more connected to the emotional body.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's bodies above that. But, you know, I just think about that, how we worship the intellect and we go to the intellect for verification, and we want to see nuts and bolts and physical proof, you know, of non-physical events, but even by their own science, they know there's at least 11 dimensions out there. And if you look at all the life just on this dimension alone, you know, one would think the other dimensions as well would have something similar. You know, maybe the rules are different and the energies, the frequencies are different, but you know, who knows, you know, what's on the other dimensions.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I mean, the problem with the scientific community is if they can't measure it, feel it, you know, see it, touch it, taste it, they're just not interested in looking at it. Because, you know, and the main reason for this isn't because, I don't think because they're not interested, but I think it's fear of ridicule from peers. And the fact that, you know, they're putting their jobs on the line. You know, a lot of scientists that look at this particular phenomena, and, you know, the UFO phenomena, the dimensional beings phenomena, and all that kind of stuff, they're, you know, they're kind of shunned by mainstream science, and it all becomes fringe science. And having been in science for, you know, all those years, you're very aware of the fact that fringe science is mocked and sneered upon by, you know, mainstream scientists. And there's such a push for people to be published in things like Nature, and this publish and perish mentality of science is really going to, or it's undoing, I think, personally, because there's no freedom of discovery and learning and exploration beyond what you can see, touch, and feel in the laboratory.
Yeah, it does seem like if you really go back to all of the great scientists, you know, that came up with all the major discoveries, almost in every case, they say that, you know, I don't know where it came from. It just came to me from some unseen force or consciousness or intelligence. And, you know, and so, you know, all of these great works actually came from the unseen. So one would think that you would be trying to tap into the unseen to bring through more information and more great discoveries.
Absolutely, and it does not just. I guess it's not just associated with science either. I mean, there's all Beethoven, people who are involved in the Renaissance and the classics. A lot of these are saying, I don't know where this comes from. Just it's given to me from somewhere." And you know, at my time here at the ranch, my mind is slightly open. You know, definitely opening up to the fact that the stuff comes from somewhere else. Like the experiences I've had here, I cannot explain with my scientific background and my understanding of the way nature works. So there's definitely something out there that we're not looking at properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's going to take people like you and other people that have a good foundation in science to actually, you know, make this alternate reality or this higher reality, whatever you want to call it. There's got to be some way of grounding it, you know, because you know, it's funny, the stuff is here is repeatable. I mean, the orbs are here all the time. Mm-hmm. With the infrared spotlight and the night vision, you know, we're able to use technology to observe them in real time, flying around, interacting with people. Yeah. The ships here, it's repeatable. The ships come on mm-hmm. a regular basis. They don't match any known, you know, they're definitely unknowns or unidentified. You know, so I'm not saying, I mean, it could be some exotic back engineering stuff. It could be from the Pleiades. It could be from Orion. You know, to bring that into the thing, then you have to get outside the box to really realize what's going on. But any way you look at it, they're unidentified.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think the main difficulty with science is it may be unidentified, but how do they measure it? Like, I mean, you can. What you need to do is measure things, record everything that you possibly can, and then apply some kind of statistical rigor to it. And then people might actually sit and look at you. But I have a strange feeling that you're just going to get ridiculed all the time, unfortunately.
Oh yeah.
Until maybe you get another couple of generations go through the scientific field, as you know, that there are more and more people that are coming that are enlightened, they're awakened, and they're looking at this kind of stuff from a different kind of angle. And, you know, mm-hmm. maybe then it will become a little bit more accepted. But unfortunately, as science stands at the moment, there's just going to be a lot of ridicule. But some scientists are stepping out of that social sort of science arena where, you know, everything has a program, is programmed to function in a certain way, where you do your science, you write a paper, you publish it. Some people are stepping out of that now, and as you know, there are some good scientists doing some good work in this sort of extra-dimensional sort of area in UFO studies, and yeah. So fingers crossed, man.
Yeah, we've had people like John Mack, you know, and then we've got Bob Dean, you know, with the highest clearance, you know, in the military, Cosmic uh-huh. Top Secret, and Clifford Stone, which was Crash Retrievals, and you've got the head of the FAA talking about all the UFOs that mm-hmm. they have on radar. You know, the people coming out now are of such a high caliber and high standing, and their credentials are impeccable. So I just don't see why now anybody in their right mind could continue to dismiss the reality that UFOs are here. And they are interacting with people, and the evidence is overwhelming. But we still have these people like Seth Shustak with SETI out there, you know, acting like there's no physical evidence, no contact, no ships here, and still using radio waves to contact
mm-hmm. yeah.
contact ships. And I'd love to hear from your perspective of how effective you think radio waves, trying to pick up radio waves, would be concerning. You know, beings that might be 1,000, you know, a million, even a billion years ahead of us in evolution and technology.
I think it's a bit of a joke, to be honest with you, but it's difficult. It's difficult for me to be completely subjective about that because I've had things in my room visiting me and I've seen stuff. So for me, you don't need to point your radio telescopes at the sky. You need to spend more time looking down here on Earth because they're kind of hanging around. Radio waves, it won't be long before we're not using radio waves like that anymore. So, you know, I think it's not necessarily a waste of government money because they don't get government money anymore, but they need to be thinking a little bit closer to home, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like it makes common sense that whoever these beings are, they're probably bending space and time and moving beyond the speed of light to get here. And why would they be using a radio? What do they do? Have to park for like a while to get a signal?
Well, they wouldn't be able to have their radio signals keep up with them. They'd be ahead of their radio signals before they send them.
Yeah.
So they get here before their radio signal.
Yeah, it's like we've got to park here next to Neptune for a year and a half and wait for the signal to get to us to tell us where the next destination is.
And you're obviously assuming that they actually need radio signals to communicate with each other as well, which, you know, if you're on that kind of a level and you're that far evolved, I doubt very much that you would need radio signals to communicate. Just for a small analogy, you have whales on this planet that you can have a whale on the other side of the planet to another whale, and they can communicate through song. And that's through water. So, I mean, that's just, you know, one analogy that you can draw. You don't really need radio waves.
Yeah, it doesn't make, you know, they have a lot of that communication, you know, instant communication and action at a distance.
Yep.
All these new theories that they've proven and that shows that, you know, you can have instantaneous communication. And why would you be using a radio wave? You know, if we already know about this, you would think some advanced civilization would be using some type of a spiritual technology or a technology that would have, you know, instant communication anywhere, you know, even probably through the dimensions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe they have some kind of technology that they can apply to themselves where they are in constant contact with other members of their species. Maybe not, you know, maybe all of them. Who knows?
Yeah, they might have a whole telepathic race, which
absolutely
transcends all time and space, and they have constant, instant communication, which would be a real bummer down here because, you know, all the politicians and everybody else would be out of work.
What you mean? You'd be able to know what they really mean.
Yeah.
Lives would become redundant. And then where would they be?
There'd be instant karma. They would be busted instantly. And
I reckon.
You know, nobody would even listen to him anymore, which I think that's where we're going. I think we are.
I think people have pretty much disengaged anyway, haven't they?
It's really looking that way. It's everything has become a really bad joke. You know, I think even voting, the Republicrats, you know, it doesn't matter who you vote for, anything.
Yeah.
People are waking up to that fact. And, you know, it's amazing now the banksters, they're starting to arrest a bunch of banksters, you know, starting with Iceland. Which I think is awesome. They just, like, forgave the debt, got rid of these guys, said, we don't owe you. You didn't create anything other than enslavement. And sayonara, and they took back their banks. And then they threw a bunch of the banksters in jail. And now that seems to be an evolving process. A lot of other banksters are going to jail now. So hopefully we can clean this mess up.
Well, let's hope it's not too late and it hasn't gone too far. And the interesting thing about Iceland is since they made that change to the banking sector, they're actually doing okay now as well. So, you know, you can move in the right direction if you're willing to make big changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, I was just looking that they're flourishing now. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of, you know, this elitist program. You know, I was trying to, you know, one of the women here, we won't mention her name, but she was from England. She was really having trouble with us talking about the Queen and how we just weren't into it, you know, and the Cinderella story of the prince getting married and everything else. And, you know, I asked her, I said, well, you know, how does that fit in with unity consciousness? You know, we're all equal. Everybody's one and we're all connected. You know, everything is connected. How does elitism and perpetuating of this elitism and special people and this huge uneven dispersal of wealth, how does that even fit into an enlightened state of being? And I think the light went on, hopefully, but it's hard to break out of that dream.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, as far as elitism is concerned, it doesn't really have any place in that unity consciousness that you discuss. And I remember often at work when I was, you know, looking, there were lots of highly paid scientists around me and I was doing pretty well. And I remember seeing people coming in and cleaning the bathrooms. And I used to often think to myself, why is it more important that I sit in front of my computer and I do my science and, you know, somebody make sure that the bathroom's clean when I go to the bathroom? It didn't make any sense to me that there was this huge divide in pay and jobs. I mean, it's just a job, regardless of whether you clean the toilet 9 to 5 or whether you sit in front of a computer and you do science 9 to 5. I mean, it shouldn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm. You know, to you know,
me anyway.
Too, like here, it's people often come here and they're looking for for me, you know, and they'll see me down in a ditch all dirty or you know, yep. I'm cleaning a toilet, you know, overflowed toilet or something like that. And, yep. you know, they're going, where's James, you know? And I go, oh, that guy just sits in his tower. He never comes down. You know, I just joke around with him, you know, pick up a shovel and help me out here. You know,
yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny because they go, well, when's he going to come out, you know? And I go, oh, and I'll sit there talking for him for a while, and all of a sudden they go, wait a second, you're him, you know? You know
exactly.
Yeah, it'll dawn on them that you know, that's just as important to talk to the ditch digger as it is anybody else, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the way I've always looked at it. I just see everybody has a story and everybody, you know, has you know, their own unique purpose for being here.
Absolutely.
And, you know, some stories are totally awesome, you know, but, you know, some stories need to evolve, you know, it's like...
Yeah, they absolutely do. The program needs to evolve, man.
Yeah. I like Byron Katie's work, you know, she, who are you without your story, you know, and it really stumps people. They go, they start telling you this whole story, and I go, but who are you without that story, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and you go, wait a second, yeah, I'm totally creating this story and acting it out and believing it, and maybe there's something bigger behind the story, and that's when people really start waking up.
And that's you as an individual.
Yeah. It looks like we're getting close to the end of the hour here. I don't know. Do we have any other guests on that want to come on? Or I think you're probably the last guest.
John wants to come on.
Okay.
Are you ready for John?
Yeah.
Here you go, man. Hello.
Hello.
James. Hi, John.
Hey, welcome to the ranch. For those that don't know John's the producer for the documentary that Contact has begun, and we've just reworked it and put out a whole new version, and it's just amazing. It just keeps you right on the edge of your seat, and you know, I think it's amazing how it's been redone. Are you with us?
Yeah, it was. It's an incredible experience, you know, recording your story. It was a privilege for me and Michael Knight, you know, he's a documentary maker. He was the director, and it was a small unit, my son Chase. So you allowed us to have full access to your records, your engagement with us, and... you know, even bringing in people that were famous and infamous from, you know, Robbie Williams from England to, you know, above Top Secret and all the way through to little people like myself. It was a great experience and a privilege, and thank you.
Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for actually making the video. I've had so many people start to do it, and I turned down some big offers, too, with a lot of money. You know, for the life story, because I knew they were going to butcher it and screw it up. And to me, it wasn't about the money. It was about getting the message out. And you guys just did an incredible job of getting it out there. And I think the only way it could have been done is to have some enlightened producers at work. And I can't thank you enough for having the awareness to even understand the... of what's really happening here and the spiritual component to it and just knowing that the truth is even more awesome than the fiction.
Well, yes, and that's what you've done. And the beautiful thing with this is that, you know, we privately did this. We did not take any monetary sources from outside. And with that, we had in my opinion, a decision-making ability that is not common in the industry. People talk mm-hmm. about common sense. I often now wonder if it is not uncommon sense. And I know that you have been said that you make a lot of money. Well, I'll tell you, as the producer of it, I haven't made money, and you haven't. But it's not about the money, and I'm not saying it from that standpoint. But Beyond Words Publishing in Portland, Oregon, has picked us up. We've re-released your story recently. In my opinion, it has been made current. It actually was ahead of its time. You knew that. I did not. I know it now. And it's been released. It's going to go worldwide. It's going to be streamed and videos and DVDs, which will actually be a thing of the past, because we're really dealing with technology here, and you've known this forever. And the communication, you know, the non-locality. I mean, you've got scientists. I'm not a scientist. I'm really just an individual that's interested in, you know, in the people's stories. And I've had my own experiences from seeing power-ups to you charging and recharging batteries. I mean, filming you, we had to designate which side of the body would go on. One side it would charge, one side it would drain. I mean, these are the highest, best batteries that I was capable of purchasing. And you'd either drain them or charge them. And that right there would make anybody giggle. I don't know about anybody. It made me giggle.
Yeah. I think it's nice, too, is you actually came here and got to see the ships yourself, and you saw some massive triangle ships and you know, a lot of power-ups and just phenomenon that couldn't be explained.
Well, the whole thing is unexplainable with our little mind, and I think you used the word cognitive dissonance, and that explains a lot. But I have seen something on the mountain. It is a long ways away, and I've seen it personally. I've seen power-ups. Now, I don't know what it is, but as I told George Norrie when we were there face-to-face and invited him to come to your ranch, and to my knowledge, that has not transpired, but the offer is open, and you did it very gently and beautifully, and he's a great man, and he does terrific, terrific exposure, but what happens in my experience is that once you see this, whatever it is, the only thing I know is it isn't swamp gas, it's not weather balloons, and I just flew all the way across the country. I just arrived here and from Maine. I'm in Northeast Harbor, Maine, and your film, is going to be shown in the Night Sky Festival in Bar Harbor, Maine, featured, and it's sponsored by Sylvania, the Jackson Lab, Allied Wales, and so you are, unbeknownst to you, because I'm not even certain you're aware of this, there's support out there, and people are truly fascinated with this. And a story is going to be told, and it'll either get out there or it won't. And I think it has a life of its own.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get into the Sundance Film Festival and a few other ones out there to really get a message out. Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, John, and sticking with this and getting this information out. I know it's been quite a journey and a huge expense of time and energy and resources and what you've done for the planet and the people. Again, I can't thank you enough.
Well, I accept that and I thank that, James, but I'm going to come back at you and thank you for the work that you're doing at the ranch and your support. And I know, listen, we all have friction, but out of friction comes, you know, a burnishment. Maybe we can get rid of our sharp edges. And, you know, it's neat. And it is working. And it's not hundreds of us. It isn't a lone journey. There's millions of us. It's worldwide. Mm-hmm. And actually, for some of us, we know it's bigger than that. And thank goodness. There's intelligence outside of this space, and if there isn't, then it's certainly been an experience. I want to thank you, James, and it's my pleasure to know you.
All right. Hey, well, thanks so much for coming on the show. We're out of time for the first hour.
All righty.
And, again, keep up the great work.
All right. Bye.
All right. Well, again, so much for the first hour. That went by fast. I know we had Vincent holding on the line. Sorry, Vincent. I would love to get you on the show. Maybe next week we can get you on the show. I know you've got an awesome story. And we're going to have to go into the second hour now with Mark Stevens, who is just awesome. And definitely listen to this man if you want to get your rights back. And remember who you are. This is the way to do it. So anyway, it's James Gunn with As You Wish Talk Radio signing off. Have a great evening. I'm going out to the field to Skywatch. Greetings. I'm your host, James Gilliland, and we've got another great show today. We've got all kinds of issues coming up for people across the land right now, and I can't think of a better person than Mark Stevens to help shed some light on this. And he's the author of Adventures in Legal Land, a scathing expose on the true nature of government based on real courtroom experience. He also hosts the No State Project, a weekly radio show dedicated to bringing about a voluntary society heard on 10 a.m. FM affiliates. The show is live every Saturday from 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Mark Stevens knows how to make judges and bureaucrats squirm and worry with his powerful methods of simple critical questioning that deals with factual reality instead of legal fictions and deception. So without any further ado, I want to bring Mark on the show. Mark, are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's an honor. I'm privileged. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah. I don't know if you've heard about some of the things we've been going through. We've had six court appearances, and three judges have been dismissed. We've gone through two prosecuting attorneys, it seems, and we keep going back. You know, I don't know how we keep going back, but maybe we can shed some light on that. But it's been pretty insane. But I'd love to hear, for the first time listeners that don't really know what this is all about. You know, some of the things that you talk about how the state, you know, is a fiction. And a lot of these courts are fictions, too. They don't have any real teeth, so to speak, once you understand that. So I don't know where you want to start off with that, but maybe just kind of why they are a fiction.
Well, the courts aren't fictions. The courts are buildings.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, the idea that the people that are operating in there constitute a court very well may be just a fiction, you know, because it's all based on the state. They do everything in the name of the state, whether it's a state of New Hampshire, a state of California, or a state of Victoria if you're in Australia. And why it's a fiction, it's one of those things that, you know, like prove a negative. It's just one aspect where one situation where we can do that, because the state is political. We know that there were no United States, whether it was the state of North Carolina or the state of New York prior to July 4th, 1776. What changed from July 3rd to July 4th? Just men put things on a piece of paper. Actually, it was July 2nd, but we'll go with what most people think is historically accurate. And it was just a perception that people had. They just changed. That's really all that changed, was the perception. In fact, even in the New Hampshire Constitution, it says that the state is a body politic. And that's where it all starts to really break down, knowing that it's political, that's not geographic. They want you to believe that, oh, you're standing here on Fifth and Main, that's the state. No, the state is political. It's a body corporate and a body politic, and being that the body politic is made up of citizens, and citizens are members of the body politic owing a duty of allegiance in return for a duty of protection, the fact that the government, the people that call themselves a government, because there is no government, just the men and women, because their support is always compulsory, and even by their own laws, there's no duty to protect you. So if there's no duty to protect you, there's no duty of allegiance, and there's no citizens, and the whole thing collapses.
So the could you go further that the support is compulsory?
Nobody has a choice on whether there's going to be government services or not, whether they're going to pay for them or not. You pay, or you go to jail, or you get shot in the process, and they take all your stuff. There's no... You know, some people, Ron Paul supporters, have called my show, and a number of them years ago when he was running the first time, saying that Ron Paul is not for taxation. He is not violating the non-aggression principle, yada, yada, and because he supports only, you know, excise taxes, and there's no force involved. Well, of course there's force involved. Why should I have to pay, if I'm selling gasoline, why should there be an excise tax in that? I can't sell gas to you freely and voluntarily, and I'll bring it to the market on a voluntary basis because I have to pay the tax. So an excise tax, all taxes, there is no choice. Just the fact that just because I don't have to, I can choose not to pay for gas doesn't make it any less coercive. It's just like people saying, well, Mark, you can always leave Mesa if you don't want to. That doesn't take – the fact that I can leave does not take away or change the coercive nature of the way these people called government provide the services. Mm-hmm. We can all move to Somalia tomorrow. Who's ever left is still going to be forced to pay.
Yeah. So basically, you know, basically standing in non-agreement, just saying, you know, I neither agree or consent to any of this, seems like that would kind of disarm, but I guess you have to know a little bit more than that.
Well, I spoke to someone in New Hampshire a couple of weeks ago, and he's a police officer in Coos County, COOS, up northern New Hampshire. And he's prosecuting, he's acting as a prosecutor, which they're, I guess, permitted to do in New Hampshire. It's a common thing. It's a misdemeanor. And I asked him to tell me, you know, all I do is ask questions. And if you ask the right questions and not worry about, you know, bruising someone's ego or upsetting the judge, or if you ask questions and don't accept any sacred cows, you'll get the same results. So I asked this police officer who insisted that the laws of the state of New Hampshire were applicable to my client. Well, what facts do you rely on to prove that the law is applicable to my client? He didn't understand the question, so I asked him again. What facts do you rely on? Now, remember, this is a misdemeanor proceeding that the guy's in. This is before the trial. He's supposed to have the evidence. He's supposed to have facts. We're trying to get facts from him for pretrial. And so I restate the question. What facts do you rely on to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the laws of the state of New Hampshire are applicable to my client? And he answered directly, and it's just a direct quote. I don't have any facts. So he thinks because he's this average gung-ho mom-pa and apple pie, whatever, you know, American, the law and order, he says to me, well, this is bordering on the ludicrous. I said, why? He says, because you're implying that the law doesn't apply to some people. So I don't think I'm implying anything here. I think from your own mouth, you don't have any evidence that applies to my client. I'm not concerned with anybody else at this point.
Yeah.
I'm only concerned, you know, with my client right now, and you don't have any evidence. And so you try to be professional, and I don't want to insult people, but you it's hard not to in a situation like this. It's only – I'm from Long Island, so I'm trying not to be sarcastic. So I don't want to misunderstand. I don't want to misunderstand you, Rick. I want to make sure I've got you, your position here. You think it's ludicrous because, okay, you believe that my client is subject to the laws of the state of New Hampshire. When I ask you what facts you rely on to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they actually apply to him, you tell me you don't understand the question and you don't have any facts. And you think I'm being ludicrous. is that true? And I hate, you know, the thing is, I've done this for 15 some odd years now. It's not an isolated incident, James. There are no facts that the law applies to anybody or anybody is within the state. These are all fictions that if you challenge it just by asking for the facts, you can get the same admissions. I've done it with the IRS for years. They admit the same thing. We don't have any evidence.
Yeah. I've noticed that they just say this is the way it is, you know. Why do you think you're special, you know, or that's about all they can come up with, you know.
The agent that I spoke to, I had a different tax agent that I spoke to in New Hampshire that said basically the same thing as your first example, that just the way it's done. I said, I understand this is the way you do it. Is it arbitrary? Is it based on evidence? I mean, did you just pull it out of thin air? Is your procedure based on any evidence? So here I'm asking, his name was Chris, I'm asking about the facts that he's relying on to show that my client's obligated to do this registration. And he's got nothing. All he can do is shuck and jive and try to dodge the issue and lie, saying he's not the one that made the determination. And so what he says to me, because this is what you'll get, just like you said. This is another one of their favorite ones, when they say, Chris said to me, Mark, let me ask you a question. Do you talk English? And I could see if I was talking to somebody in Washington or, you know, California. I was talking to somebody in New Hampshire who kind of has the same silly, you know, a similar Northeastern accent that I do. But that's just an ad hominem way of saying, Mark, I know I have no evidence, but it's not important to me.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Yeah, they always try to sidetrack you. You know, I'm curious. I know in some of our paperwork, we've been working with some problems here at the ranch, and we've asked that, you know, right up front. You know, they haven't met a cause of action. They have nothing. They don't have a damaged or injured party. They said they had complaints, but they can't produce any. So then they detracted that. You know, it's just unbelievable why this thing has gone on so far. But, you know, we've been hitting them with all these affidavits, and they haven't rebutted any of them or answered any of them. But they just keep going as if we don't exist. I mean, no answers to anything, but they just keep pushing ahead. You know, I'm blown away, and I'm trying to wonder if they speak English.
I've had them say their favorite phrase when they want to reject my paperwork or position or question that I have. Well, it's legalistic gibberish. And you're either illiterate or you're a liar. It's written at least an eighth grade level of English. Mm-hmm. So if you think it's gibberish, then you're disingenuous or illiterate. And it's just like you said before, it's just distractions, just to get you off point. And anytime you hold their feet to the fire to the facts, which they have none, mm-hmm. they will always use distraction and misdirection. That's their standard operating procedure. Mm-hmm. They have to do that. Like you mentioned before, it was a good one. Are you what makes you special?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's got nothing to do with me. It's got everything to do with your lack of evidence.
You step out of the herd, and even the herd will come after you. It's amazing because they're so programmed. You know, this herd consciousness has got to go. But the what's interesting is I'm trying to think of a good example. Like let's say the state of Washington, versus whoever. Basically, the state of Washington, you know, from my understanding, is just a corporation, and I know the courts here are actually registered as for-profit corporations, which is interesting, and so you've got the state is a corporation. I don't know if they're a for-profit corporation, and these courts work for the state, and they're for-profit corporations, and every level of the state is a corporation, and I'm trying to figure out how, and then they have all these fines for all these different things and code compliance and fees for this and all these other things, and I'm trying to figure out how there can't be a total conflict of interest there, or if not, a conspiracy going on where it's just a big scam.
Well, there's definitely a conflict, and this is why I always like to look at the situation, you know, and get as clear an understanding of the facts that are before me before starting to formulate some kind of defense. And whether it's a corporation or a body politic, it's still a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And like Santa Spooner wrote, that all that legislative juggling is just to, and I'll paraphrase, all that legislative juggling is just to try to distract from the consequence of the facts. And when you have a situation here, and I've been attacked, you know, for years on like some kind of theory, or, you know, no, it's not a theory when I point out, and it's an absolute irrefutable beyond any reasonable doubt whatsoever. So when you go into court, whether you call it judicial or administrative, corporate, it doesn't matter. The fact is, you have A, which is the judge, forcing you, B, to answer C, the prosecutor or the cop's complaint. A, forcing B to answer C means those facts tell you one thing. There is a relationship between A and C. So however else you term it, doesn't matter. It's not going to change. Because if there wasn't a relationship, why would A be forcing B to answer C's complaint? If there was no relationship, it has to be. So the best you can get, that's just the way it's done. That doesn't tell me anything. That doesn't change the facts. We know that's how you do it. So what I get into is, explain how that's not a conflict of interest. Just explain that. How does that work? What is the nature of your relationship to, you know, to the police office? And it throws him into a rage. I can freely admit that, because, you know, we're dealing with psychopaths. And when you call them on their fictions, that's how they respond. So, you know, so you can say the state of Washington's a corporation. It's still you haven't peeled the onion back far enough. It's just men and women. So just like any other corporation, whether it's Acme or, you know, Walmart, whoever it happens to be, there is no corporate person. There's just men and women providing services. And that's why I say, like on my radio show, government is just a group of men and women providing services on, you know, on a pay or get shot basis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, so.
So basically, the fiction is that it's just a fiction. The whole ceremony is a fiction that they're taking you through, and it's up to us to figure out how to point that out or not participate in it.
Well, they're forcing you to participate. Yes,
yeah.
What I call it is damage control. So we want to limit the amount of damage that these predators want to do, and it's absolutely beyond any reasonable doubt whatsoever to show that these are predators. These are economic predators,
mm-hmm.
And everything from the word go is a lie. It's you know, the fact that, you know, the cop thinks that you're within his jurisdiction, and this is why I wrote recently. I did a petition for habeas corpus for a friend in New Hampshire, a demo with Cop Lock, and what I just lay out in plain English, the only jurisdiction that the judge or cop has is their willingness to initiate and carry out violence against you. A cop's jurisdiction over you is the degree of violence he's willing to use on you.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. There's no other rational way to look at that. Everything else is public relations to cover up that violence.
Wow, that's interesting to think about that.
Ask a cop. Ask a cop to explain what his jurisdiction means factually. She said, look, just play this. Look, I'm not interested in what the lawyers have to say, and I'm sure that you as a cop don't know that. I want you to explain what it means in lay terms so that I can understand. When you say you have jurisdiction over me, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And just wait.
Yeah.
Because you get this bewildered deer in the headlight look. They cannot put to you in words, and if they start, and if anybody thinks about it long enough, if any cop or IRS agent thinks about it long enough, they are not going to want to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you own me?
Yeah.
That is what it's coming down to. Except for physical violence, please explain to me what your jurisdiction is over me. Why can't I just walk away from you? The guy Chris up in New Hampshire, when I described him as the aggressor, I said, look, Chris, you are the aggressor here. And he flips out. Oh, I'm the aggressor now. Yeah, I'm like, well, who initiated the contact? Who's making threats of sending other agents to the man's place of business? They don't want you and I to discuss with them the facts, because it undoes or it tears apart the facade of legitimacy. They don't want to be seen or thought of as just one thugs, which is exactly what they are.
Boy, that's interesting. I just had a short glitch here. No, it's still going on. It's funny. Whenever I get to some really heated stuff, my computer, and it's a brand new computer, it's a Mac, all of a sudden the recorder starts going off and jumps around and goes to different directions and sometimes turns off. But, you know, obviously, you know, we must be getting into some heated conversations. But, you know, it's interesting. I noticed I heard another interview what you did. You were talking about the traffic courts and how, you know, basically the way they haul you in there, and they you know, give you the summons, and you have to go in and deal with it, and you can challenge it, and all that whole enchilada, how that's all based on a fiction. Basically, all you have to do is say, well, where's the damaged party, or who's signed the or where's an injured party, and they can't come up with anything, and that just kind of kills the case right there.
Well, it can. It's just that they get, you know, some of them are getting wise to that, and it is really one step beyond the jurisdiction, but it's still always a great issue, and I hit the issue very hard. A lot of times they will come back, though, when they'll say, well, the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that ties people up.
Yeah. Let's say I get a ticket and I go in there. So first thing I'd do is I would say, okay, prove to me you have jurisdiction in this matter.
Well, I wouldn't look at it as far as the judge proving jurisdiction. A lot of people are under the misconception that the judge has a burden of proof. The judge does not. The judge has an obligation to ensure that there's evidence before him proving he has jurisdiction. Otherwise, the judge legally is supposed to assume there's no jurisdiction there until there is, it is proven to the contrary by competent evidence. Not opinions, competent evidence. And unfortunately, I've had people call my show and say, well, the judge refused to prove, the judge is not there to prove the jurisdiction. So what I do is I put the burden of proof where it's supposed to be, and that's on the one who is actually filed a complaint and the prosecutor. So I would always put it to the judge, what evidence has been presented to you to convince you that there's jurisdiction here over me? Because if he's insisting that there's jurisdiction, I want to know who gave him the evidence. Where is it? What evidence is he relying on? And where are they, you know, in the court, you know, for me to challenge? And not they, always there in traffic.
Yeah, they usually skip over all that and they just go, well, there's this rule and this regulation and this law and everything else, and you broke these laws, and they just totally avoid the first question, you know, it seems like. And so you have to bring it back again. Well, where's... It seems like you have to just keep bringing it back to that single point. Like, okay, why do you have jurisdiction? You know, prove to me you have jurisdiction in this matter.
Yeah, it's interesting you said broke these laws, because that's typical of what they will say. And I would say to them, excuse me, have you? Because remember, they're most of the time they get you getting people on statutory violations like tax evasion or you know, things like not filing a return. All these are statutory violations. They're mala prohibita, where it's only a crime by virtue of the statute. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't even be given a second look. And if so, what I like to do, especially if it's a criminal proceeding, because you can double bind the judge pretty easy with the presumption of innocence. So wait a minute, am I presumed innocent of all the alleged charges? Well, yes, of course you are. So, well, have you presumed at this particular point in time that you have jurisdiction, that these laws of the state of New Hampshire apply to me? Now he's stuck. Well, of course the laws apply to you, Mark. Then, wait a minute, it's a statutory offense. You've already assumed that the statutes apply to me? That's an essential element of crime. How can you, so you put him in this double bind. The judge can't go by the PR that you're presumed innocent, because it's the because with a statutory crime, they have to presume the statutes don't apply to you until it is proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they do. And they will always assume that the laws apply to you. Well, what evidence do you have, and who gave it to you, sir? Sir, and that's why when you mentioned, because you've been in court many times, it's you're very experienced at that. When they say things, when you're asking for facts, and they spit back, well, we got this regulation, or we've got the stat, you know, that's not what I'm asking you. So yeah. I would, you know, objection, I'm moved to strike. Just be responsive. What facts do you rely on? So, sir, beyond your opinion that the laws apply to me, what facts do you rely on to prove that? And who gave you those facts? Who are you relying on?
Mm-hmm. And basically, I guess there are no facts.
Well, what facts could there be? I mean, I've asked police officers and tax agents. I've asked all stripes of politicians that, you know, I've asked them, well, what is the Constitution factually? What are the laws of the state factually? I mean, it's an unorthodox question, but it has a lot of merit, because they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the laws are applicable. They just think it's cool. Well, that's just the way it's done. But they're just assuming that. It has to be based on facts. The burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt or by preponderance of evidence does not mean stacking legal opinions and assumptions up. It has to do with facts. And if they're going to charge you insist that there's jurisdiction, there has to be facts to prove that. Well, how do we know that the law is applicable if we don't know what the law is? What are they? And I've asked a tax agent point blank, would there be an obligation if there was no Constitution? No. So we established that the Constitution is absolutely essential to have a tax liability. So there has to be a connection between me and the Constitution. It's obvious. Well, if we don't know what the Constitution is, and I'll ask them, factually, what is the Constitution? I'll ask you, factually, what is the Constitution?
Boy, it's just an agreement between a bunch of men that this is how we're going to behave, I guess.
Well, we can assume it's an agreement, but if we when it gets right down to it, it's four pieces of paper written on in 1787 by men who have been dead. I think the last one died in like 1836. It's been quite a while. I think James Madison was the last one, and at least he was the last one of the signers who signed as a witness, not as a signatory. And so they've been dead for 100 and you know since 1836. I'm not going to do the math, but it's well over 150 years. So I think it's like 180 now. Anyway, it's not important. They're all dead now anyway. So we've got these four pieces of paper. And so like Sam Spoon wrote in the Constitutional Authority, the Constitution has no inherent authority. If it has any authority at all, it is only as a contract. It doesn't even purport to be a contract. If it is a contract, it's only a contract between people who signed the signatory, which nobody did. So we've got four pieces of paper. Now, what facts connect me, you, or anyone else to those four pieces of paper?
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing. So that's why I can be so confident when I'm going to court or when I'm talking to them on the phone. I know that there's no factual connection. Obviously, you don't want to ask too many questions where you don't know the answer. And it's the same thing with the laws. Factually, I mean, I had an agent, this is in the book. She said to me, "What makes you think your client's not subject to federal law, Mark?" I said, "Well, what is federal law?" She said, well, that's what Congress says. Yeah, actually, that's exactly what it is. It's the opinion of 535 men and women. She said, well, yeah. Well, what facts do you rely on that those opinions of those 535 men and women apply to my client at all? Where connect the dots?
Wow. That's a really interesting concept on looking at that. I know here there's like with Washington State there's more than one constitution. You know, they have the corporate, you know, program, and then they have the I'm trying to think of the other one. There's actually two different constitutions, and they're very different. But when the judges swear an oath, you know, to uphold the Constitution, you say, okay, which constitution are you upholding? And the corporate one or the I don't know, my mind's going blank right now, but the Republic, the Republic Constitution, because there's two. And so if they say the corporate one, you know, you say, well, I'm in the wrong building then, you know.
If you even want to go that far, if you just examine the facts, what facts do you rely on, sir, that you have jurisdiction over me? What facts? Either way, it doesn't matter which one he is operating under. Neither one of them, there's no facts that either one of them apply to you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, sir, explain. You do the same thing like I've done to comps, sir, and I've done it to. I've asked judges this, sir. Just explain to me factually how exactly. Go through the mechanics for me. It shouldn't take you more than a few seconds. Go through the mechanics and show me exactly what facts there are on how you acquired the jurisdiction over me. Or you can ask them point blank, start accepting physical violence and threats of violence against me. What is your jurisdiction over me?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're kind of baiting them into some, well, it's not violence, so I can walk away from you right now and you won't retaliate against me in any shape or form, will you?
Yeah.
It's another double bind. They don't want to admit that they're under all that paperwork is a machine gun, and they're damn well willing to. Maybe not the judges themselves because they're a bunch of gutless lawyers, but they're definitely willing to order men who aren't mentally stable to kill you or to put you in a cage at their order. So there's definitely physical violence involved. I've even had a lawyer at the Franchise Tax Board try to tell me that when the government forces you to do something, it's not a threat, duress, and coercion. So your word, you put the word government, and that changes reality for you. I said, that's what you're telling me. You're telling me you have magic words that if you do exactly the same action as me, you're not a criminal, but I am. In fact, that just happened recently. I said to a cop in Scottsdale, I said to him before I left, I said, if the three of us did business here in the Valley and we had the same support and collected our money in the same exact manner as the government, would you consider us a group of criminals? And the cop flipped out. That's it. That's offensive. I want you out of here.
Yeah, it's like the RICO Act all over again. You know, that that's where I was looking at this thing, and I mean, I'm getting a lot of really nice tidbits in here that you're dropping, some real bombs. I shouldn't call them tidbits, you know, into this whole process of how just knock it off right at the jurisdiction level is the best one. You know, I've just seen that, you know, one of the problems with, and I know that you come up against that, is educating people. You know, this sounds like a judgment, and basically it is, but, you know, the people that we've been dealing with have not responded to any affidavits. They've been nailed. There's an estoppel in place, and we've gone down this rabbit hole as far as you can go. It's just unbelievable. They have not responded to anything other than threats and, you know, and tickets, and we even A4V'd the tickets, you know, so it's like, it's like they have nothing. I mean, they have nothing to go on, but they just keep going like these Energizer bunnies, you know. And I came to the conclusion that, you know, it's not my job to educate these people as to what's going on. That's their job. But they don't even realize that they've screwed themselves. They don't even realize they already lost. And they it's amazing they just keep going, which is a major, you know, abuse of process, and you know, falls into baritry now. But you know, it's like, what do you do with these people that just don't? They just cannot comprehend what you're showing them or telling them. They really don't understand the law or any of it whatsoever. They just keep trying to run this program or this process.
Well, I don't use the excessive for value and the estoppel stuff. The estoppel has to be, you know, only the judge can grant the estoppel, and they're not going to do it unless they recognize it. So what I do to get around that is to, for example, with the IRS, I want to find out first, and I go through this process, and you can hear a lot of this on the website. I have, there's a Kimberly Clark, an IRS lawyer, that I spoke to at a pretrial conference, and then we have an entire tax hearing with the Maryland Comptroller's Office that's on the website. I mean, the entire hearing is up, and that had a very favorable. I mean, very favorable, you know, outcome. They've left the guy alone, which is nice. They dropped the entire attack. What I want to find out though is the process. I don't want to get into your code. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to read the statute and say this is how things laid out. The agent doesn't care. You know, they don't care. And I don't want to come out with some kind of procedure that I get off the internet. Oh, I'm going to do an estoppel process, or I'm going to do. They don't know it. They don't care. I want to find out what they do care about. So that's why I'll ask them. So I'll call the IRS and I'll say, look, we've got this form letter, and it's claiming my client owes X amount in his taxable income. Do you have the authority to abate the assessment or stop this computer process? If I'm not talking to someone who has that authority, I need to get to someone who does. So assuming that they do have the authority, and I said, now you don't have to go to another department to do this, right? You can abate it on your own authority. Yeah, okay, great. Because I know they like to pass the buck, and so that you want to ask, you know, in anticipation of that. Then I got to find out. So now that I know that they can't abate it, I've already determined, it's implied, that it can, you know, we know it can be abated, and that not all assessments are valid because some can be abated. So it's a really good admission to get in there. Mm-hmm. So the next thing I can ask them is, without going through any statutes, what are the grounds to have this thrown out that you would personally accept so that you can exercise your authority? You know, meeting them at their map of the world. Mm-hmm. And I'll help them out. I say, well, look, if it's arbitrary, if it's not based on facts, would that be sufficient for you? Would you then? So now I have his admission, what he's going to do, and he's agreeing with it. Great. That's why it's easier for me in doing it this way to get them to stick to it. Now, do they do it every time when it comes up that they have no facts, like this guy Chris or Rick admitted up in New Hampshire? No. I'm not saying that at all. They're criminals. Mm-hmm. Most of the time they tend to stick with that because they don't want to – I mean, because they've said it. And like I have on my website, one of the older videos that I've done, where Daniel from the Franchise Tax Board, he starts laughing because he's admitted there are no facts. He's admitted it. And I said, well, then you'll be consistent with your earlier statement that you will abate. And he says, no, I'm not going to do that. That doesn't need to be evidence. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. So a lack of evidence is not grounds to a, okay, so you, it's better and more effective to get them and what's in their head and what they will accept, because it's more, it's a lot more uncomfortable for them to contradict themselves than to have them contradict section XYZ of the Internal Revenue Code, which they haven't read and they don't care about. Mm-hmm. But the, but when you've got them in a room with their colleagues and they're contradicting themselves, they do care about that because they're losing their credibility, and that they want to maintain. So that, to me, is a much more effective way to, you know, find, you know, to hold their feet to the fire and have them be more consistent and not just throw up, well, your statute says this. They don't care. It's better to go back, but, you know, let me, and I said, look, I took some notes here, and so you said that a lack of evidence would be sufficient grounds to evade this. We've just established that, you know, you've admitted that there is no evidence. What's the problem?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. The definitely the lack of evidence, you know, and basically, as you're saying, there are no facts, there is no evidence.
Yeah, and that's the thing, James. They'll admit that to you. I get the admission, all I get two admissions all the time, and you can hear them on my website. It'll be there's no evidence, or and witnesses, and the second one is they're not qualified to do the assessments. They do it all the time. It's like going into court. Almost every witness they brought against me, I've had the judge fall over himself trying to, you know, declaring the witness incompetent. So they'll always do that. We always get them admitted to be incompetent or unqualified to do their job, and they admit that there's no evidence.
So what is the best way to do that? Let's say your witness comes up and you know they have a lack of evidence. You know, it's grounds for abatement, and then you disqualify the witness or the ones trying to bring the charges against you. So now, what is the best way of doing it? Let's say a good example is, say you've got some code violations and they're trying to nail you on that, you know, on your house or something of that nature. You know, and what's funny is these guys don't even read their own code because we're within code, you know, but.
Doesn't matter. I mean, yeah. I have an example of this on a website. It's the contraband turkey hearing. Mm-hmm. And they told me at the beginning of the cross-examination, they said, well, Mr. Stevens, you're still misunderstanding. Your client's not accused of any wrongdoing. He's accused of noncompliance. It was a code violation, mm-hmm. that he had not gotten a license and allowed inspection of his farm. And not that he did anything wrong.
Yeah.
Because I had the agent admit on the stand, on their oath, not that that means anything to me, a lie is a lie. He admitted that there was no evidence of any wrongdoing. He said there was no evidence of any complaints. There was no evidence that they had even violated the code. The only problem, as far as the inspection, as far as the health standards, they had not violated any of the standards, even though they didn't allow inspection and they didn't have a license. They were still not. They were still technically not violating anything, even if, yeah. So they had to stop me, and that's where it all comes down to. Most of these things have nothing, except for real crimes, like, you know, obviously when you've initiated violence. But these maloprohibitive, it's all about noncompliance. The drug war is about noncompliance. You didn't comply with a politician. That's all it comes down to. No, they don't read it. They just think that they believe that the laws are there, and their interpretation is all that matters. If you have a different interpretation than them, let the courts handle it. And that's their position on it. But to get them declared incompetent, it's easy. You just ask a few questions, like with a traffic ticket. Did you file a valid cause of action against me? 99% of the time, they'll say yes. Well, how many elements are in a valid assessment? They'll impeach. It's important to remember, you and I are not saying the witness is unqualified. It's usually the prosecutor or the judge that's doing that, and they'll do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can also check whatever fiction they happen to be bringing against you. Here, if it's a code violation, sir, what was the thought process that you went through to factually link me to the code? Mm-hmm. Objection, calls for a legal conclusion. The witness... And they'll impeach him for you. And if not, it'll come out that there were no facts. So you just assume the law was applicable. You have no actual evidence to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you still met your objective. So
yeah.
Whatever fiction, So it could be, sir, would there be a violation if I was not within the state of New Hampshire or the state of Washington, whatever it is? And they'll say, well, no, because the laws of the state of Washington only apply within the state of Washington. Well, that's, yeah, well, yeah. And then you go from there. Factually, what is the state of Washington? Objection, call it. They won't discuss it. I know it sounds hard to believe, but I have evidence on my website, and anybody can call a prosecutor and ask them these questions. I asked a prosecutor back, John Webb, last year in New Hampshire. It was a habeas petition hearing, a conference hearing. We had it was Keene, New Hampshire. And my big issue, of course, at the very beginning, knowing I had limited time because you only have a couple minutes to do any of this, is I said, well, a point of clarification. When Mr. Webb, his name was John Webb, I said, well, when Mr. Webb says that he's representing or appearing as the state of New Hampshire, what is he talking about? Is he talking about the body politic? And then I got cut off. The judge starts getting upset. Sir, sir, do not start with me. And you can hear that on I have the recording on the website. The judge's name was Philip Mangione. And in my experience, because I do the radio show, I consider myself a member of the media, a part of the media. Every single prosecutor I have called and asked them, what do you mean when you say state of New Hampshire or state of California? Without exception, every one of them will get upset with me and hang up. And so it's a very easy point to address, to have a witness declared incompetent and show that there's no evidence of any kind of noncompliance, because it doesn't apply to you in the first place. Give me the facts. Just like Joe Friday. Just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, so can you clarify that further, just for people that don't know, you know, what – I know a lot of people hear that, you know, where they're saying, you know, you represent the state, just what is the state? You know, I know it's a fiction, but maybe you can help clarify that for people so they can understand, you know, where you're going with that.
It's a DBA. It is nothing more than it's a pseudonym. Uh-huh. It's another name. It's like a – think of it like a pen name. Dr. Seuss, whatever, I can't remember, you know, it's a pen name. That's all it is. When you go to court, and I baited them on this, James. I tried to get some dialogue on this. I can't make it any simpler than that. It is literally a DBA, if that means, and you know, I shouldn't even say literally. It's a doing business as. Mm-hmm. It's no different than me, you, and someone else claiming to be a corporation and calling it Acme. There is no Acme. It's just the name. It's just me, you, and someone else. And that's exactly what they're doing. So when the lawyer comes in and says, John, you know, this it now comes the state of New Hampshire by and through their attorney, John Webb, and he signs it as the state of New Hampshire, it is John Webb. There's nobody else there. And so I baited them, and I did it exact. I mean, he actually signed it as the state of New Hampshire. You have to see the paperwork. Uh-huh. And that's the way lawyers, you know, prosecutors do it. And so I did the same thing. I said, state of New Hampshire by and through Mark Stevens. And I signed it, you know, on behalf of the state of New Hampshire, figuring, well, this could be considered a contempt of court. Maybe, you know, they didn't want to make an issue of it. They wouldn't hold me in contempt for that. I said I was representing the state of New Hampshire. And when you sign a court document, everyone should be aware of this. When you sign a court document, you're certifying that everything is accurate. Mm-hmm. So technically, I was committing a fraud.
Yeah.
And of course, they knew what I was doing, and they weren't going to address it.
But so, if they charge you with that, then they'd have to charge the prosecutor with the same thing. So,
yeah, he's got just as much evidence to prove it as I do. It's just words on a piece of paper. There's no simpler way to break it down. So if you can ask a prosecutor, sir, can you give me the name of someone that you're acting on behalf of? Mm-hmm. They can give me the name, and I've asked them. It's in the book. Bill Burke, he used to be a prosecutor right here. Bill, can you give me the name of one person in Jerome or Page that you are acting on behalf of? Just one. They can't get. Come on. I mean, it's ridiculous. There is no state. There is no. It's a fiction. And when a prosecutor comes in, and says he's representing the state. No, he's not. It's him. Mm-hmm. It's him. Because if you've got someone like Nafong, the guy in from the falsely accused the lacrosse team a number of years ago, he's the one that was disbarred. He's the one that's looking at going to jail, not the state, because there is no state. The prosecutor, the one who's actually responsible for it, is the one. It's just like Spooner said. He was right on almost everything. It's just to get away from the consequence of the facts. It's the prosecutor. And if you ask him for evidence, I could pretty much guarantee you're not going to get a shred of evidence. You'll get a lot of well, I have a bar card. That doesn't tell me you have a client.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a state attorney. That doesn't tell me that you have a client. Give me the evidence. I don't want your opinion. I don't want your legalistic gibberish. Mm-hmm. Give me facts. Show me. And they can't.
Yeah. So you say show me a client and they don't have a client, or show me a damaged or injured party would be this similar. I guess you could go, you know, there's many ways to skin a cat.
Well, sure. You can say, what evidence do you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt my presence within the plaintiff? What evidence do you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt my presence within the plaintiff? They have to prove you within the plaintiff's state. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. The more you examine it, the stupider it sounds. It's almost – it's tough to even say these things with a straight face.
I don't think they'd even understand that one.
They don't. In fact, I had that prosecutor, that cop acting as a prosecutor in New Hampshire, says you're confusing the two. Really explain that. He says, there's the state, which is the ground, and then there's the plaintiff state, which is the government.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. 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 Okay. Explain to me, sir, then how your jurisdiction extends to me. Which they can't. Oh, you have jurisdiction over the ground. Fine. How does it extend to me? It's just Yeah, there's six ways to go about any of it, and it's all you're doing is challenging them on the BS that they're spewing and trying to use to cover up the violence that underlies it all.
Well, if they say, you know, I have jurisdiction over the ground or the land that you're on, and by that means, you know, we can come in and do whatever we want.
Oh, so you own it?
Yeah. I own the land.
You own the land by virtue. Oh, so you're the owner of all this land.
You're asking them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And we've asked questions like that, and it's, well, no, of course not. I work for the government, which opens up another can of worms. You work for the government, but you're not the government. No. Well. Factually, what is the government that you work for then? Can I pick up a rock and hit it?
Yeah.
Well, it's a system. You work for a system who pays you. It's craziness. And the new book, which I'll have out, you know, in just a few months, I go through and show a lot of the psychological and social pressure that is brought to bear on these people when you're doing this. You're talking about ripping someone's reality and whole life out from under them by asking a few questions. When you ask a prosecutor in court, sir, is there evidence of a complaining party? And he's, the state of Washington. I move to strike non-response. It's just yes or no. Is there evidence of a complaining party? I've never got a responsive answer to that, ever. They start to think about it, and like, oh, what do we do? And they'll look at their notes. No, it's not there.
Yeah.
It's not there. And it's understandable why none of these prosecutors will come on the air with me or talk to me even off air and tell me what they mean by the state, because there is no state. They have no evidence. I'll ask them point blank, and, you know, what facts – what do you mean by that? And they'll say, well, what do you – they'll get upset with me. Well, where are you going with this, Mark? So just answer the question. No, you tell me where you're going with this. Now, I've already known. I know, Jay. I'm not going to get an answer to this. So I might as well be upfront and say, well, this is where I'm going with it, Rick.
Yeah.
I don't think that you have any evidence. I think that when you use the phrase state of California, I think you know it's a DBA for you. I think you know it's just a pseudonym, and there's no facts or any kind of substance back, you know, behind it at all. You know that, and that's why you won't answer the question. And they say, well, have a nice day, Mark. And they hang up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have recordings, but they didn't agree, so I don't release them.
Yeah.
One of these days we'll get that. But anyone can do that, and I encourage people to do it. You don't have to do it if you're in Washington. You don't have to do it in Washington and worry about retaliation. Call someone in Victoria, South, in South Wales, New South Wales, or Melbourne. I pick on Washington all the time because not only am I well out of range of their guns, but their constitution is very, very explicit, you know, which is just public relations. So it's easy for me to put them in a bind, and to be able to bring out that they have no evidence and that they're really just a gang of criminals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, it all boils down to the only use of force is all they've got. I mean, they don't have any facts, any evidence, any basis, other than the gun and the little badge they're given,
Right. You're absolutely right. It all comes down to force, and that's why when we talk about jurisdiction, accepting physical force and threats of physical force against me, what is your jurisdiction over me? Mm-hmm. And it becomes real clear to anybody that's all it is.
Yeah. And so basically, just that one, just coming up with that one, they're probably not going to answer that. Or they can't.
They're not going to want it. Right. And it's just like with Chris in New Hampshire. I have him on record with a witness admitting, I have no jurisdiction here. That's what he said. A witness. Now, he lies and says it's not what he said. And that's because when he said he had no jurisdiction here, I said, well, let me write that down. I said, I want to make sure I'm quoting you accurately here, Chris. I have no – I know I was probably coming off like kind of a jerk about it, but I wanted to make sure I had that. I said, now, if you don't have any jurisdiction here, why did you send my client anything in the mail to begin with? Mm-hmm. Then it hits him just how damaging a statement like that is. Well, I didn't say that. No, you did. Now we've got a credibility issue because I have a witness. And I said, I will testify against you. I'll file an affidavit, and I will be on the phone testifying against you. You damn well did say it. Mm-hmm. But if you do feel you have jurisdiction, we're right back at the beginning. What facts do you want?
Yeah.
So there's no way out of it. You either put up the facts or just please leave us alone.
Yeah.
Which is all we want anyway. Just leave us alone.
You know, that's basically, my program. I think about that. Okay, what am I guilty of, awakening and healing a lot of people, educating people. And I didn't really know that was a crime, And, you just think about how lame this is. And everybody that's observed what's been going on here, they just can't wrap their head around it. They go, this is the most ridiculous thing we've ever heard of. And I said, it's just harassment. It's just pure, harassment. There's no other, using the system, there's no other reason behind this. We're trying to figure out some other valid reason for what they're doing. So
it's control.
Yeah.
It's all about control.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, basically it is what it all boils down to is that, that when they realize they have no control over you, that crashes the whole program of which they depend on for their sustenance.
And their map of the world is built on a hierarchy, and they are above the hierarchy. They're higher up than us, and so they have nothing but contempt for us. Mm-hmm. The world is one big plantation.
Yeah.
I think it was Russell Means that said, welcome to the plantation, everyone. I mean, no, welcome to the reservation, everyone. Which is really, it's kind of the same thing. And it's one big, and I've called it for years, it's one big Stanford prison experiment. You've got billions of people pretending to be citizens or residents of non-existent states and countries. There are none. There are no governments. They're just gangs. And then you've got millions and millions of people on the other side of the equation that are pretending to be senators and presidents and ministers and whatnot. It's all pretend. The thing is, like I write in the new book, it doesn't matter if it's pretend. We know from the Stanford Prison Experiment, even though they knew it was fake, they still had profound psychological results and effects that caused them to become sadistic within 6 days. So it's the structure that's the problem. And when you and I come in, if we start questioning that, their perception of the world is taking a major shot. I had two people cry when I spoke in New Hampshire a couple years ago. Because they weren't ready for me to do that yet. They weren't ready to have that part of their perception torn out. And there was nothing to replace it. Because you know, it's just people. They had this idea that it was a nation gone wrong. No, there never was a nation.
Yeah, I know. That's such a hard concept to wrap your head around that, you know, because people have been programmed for so long. And I notice that I even catch myself falling back into, you know, jurisdiction things and things like that and giving power to people that really don't have it. And it's just because it's such an old program and we don't have the tools or the understanding to step out of it or hold our own in this program. But, you know, and I think that's the most valuable thing that you're giving people is the understanding and the tools to actually step outside of this gangster program we have that we call our government. But, yeah, it's just, you know, the more I look into this, the more I just, it's just a mind blower. You just go, how did it get this far?
It's just a part of the hierarchy. It's the social pressure that comes from the hierarchy, the Lord of the Flies effect, however you want to term it. It's you know, these are old concepts that they've put into place. And I put together my parking ticket study for people who may be sitting on the fence so that there's no – they're able to make these challenges and see it in person. So we just in Scottsdale, someone couldn't believe what the cop said. He said, did you file a – and I was there for that. Did you file a valid cause of action against me? I don't even know what a cause of action is.
Hmm.
Oh, my gosh. So, you know, you have – so the parking ticket study is in place so that those out there who want some proof, and you should have proof. You know, I'm a pathological liar. I'm a schmuck from Long Island. Who knows what I say is true unless you verify it for yourself. I verified all this myself, and I encourage everyone to do the same. So you can participate in a parking ticket study. You get a parking ticket where you're able to go to court. That's where it's important.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in California or Canada or England, not such a good idea. But there's no violent conflict with the police officer, and you're able to make all these challenges. You're able to ask the judge, what is the nature of your relationship to the cop who wrote the ticket? And you don't have to necessarily worry about going to jail. Well, for contempt, you have to be very professional. But you're able to make these challenges, and so you can see for yourself everything Mark said was true because he's gone through it. He's lived it. He's done it. There are examples on the website. And now I now know for myself. I've gone through. I got the ticket. Even if you lose, you have an education in that you have the direct personal firsthand experience that nobody can take away from you. You know they're criminals from top to bottom because you went in and you asked the questions, and they either they admitted they had no evidence or they ran right over you.
Yeah, because that's a one thing. That's the first thing we brought up. Did you, you know, there we just brought right off the bat, you know, there is no valid cause of action here. And we went through the three steps, you know, for a cause of action and then signed an affidavit, and they accepted it. And they didn't rebut any of this stuff. But what's weird is that, you know, they haven't even, you know, going into court, I just said, you know, right off the bat, I said, you know, there is no cause of action, you know, cause of action not been established, you know, have you rebutted any of the affidavits? You know, we went through this whole thing and the judges just keep dismissing themselves or bailing out.
Wow.
And passing it on, you know.
Well, that's always nice. I look at it where, like, you can hear this on the website, a good example where a judge, and it was a telephonic hearing, and I was on Skype helping somebody who was on the speakerphone with the court. And the judge, you know, he told the judge, sir, since you insist that there's a valid cause of action here, could you please tell me how many elements there are and where are they in this complaint? And it drove the judge nuts. And he wound up doing a continuance. And then when you know, came time for the new date, the cop didn't show up, which I think is convenient, which most of the time they don't.
Yeah, we've had two or three continuances, you know, recusals and judges just bailing out of it. You know, I'm out of here. And we even, you know, one of the judges really interfered in due process and wouldn't even let us to see the charge, what I was being charged for before we went in there. I can't go into court without being seen what's charged for. And he says, no, you can't see that document. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. And we went, wow, you know, so we just walked in there with that. We said, hey, you know, you're obstructing, you know, due process. And, you know, we don't even know what we're being charged for. So how can we even have a hearing, you know? And just that just flipped them out right there. But, Yeah, it's just been ongoing craziness here. You know, we're hitting the end of the hour, unfortunately. I know we could probably talk for three more hours. I only have an hour show. But what is the best way that people can contact you to get a hold of your information?
The website is markstevens.net, and my email is markstevens@mail.com, and they can also get me on Skype at frankrizzle3, and they're always welcome to call the show, especially if they have questions or disagree with any of the material I've ever presented.
And what's the show? How do people find out where your show is airing?
Well, they can listen to it on my website, or at, I have the network, the two networks. We originate, of course, with the LRN.FM, and a number of other stations do carry it, and then TruthFrequencyRadio.com carries it. They can reach me there. You know, they can call the show. It's on Saturdays from 4 to 7 Eastern Time, and they're always welcome to call. Again, dissent is always welcome. The show is about getting to a voluntary society, and the reason why we want that and how we get there is through a vigorous, open, honest investigation into the facts. So it's an open discussion, and there are no sacred cows. The only thing we don't talk about is religion, but when it comes to legal land and solving problems with legal land and getting to a voluntary society, whatever's presented on the show or on the website is fair game.
Great. Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's been a real eye-opener and an education, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.